Hi, everybody. Welcome to the Epilogue Podcast. This episode is brought to you by FetchClass.com. FetchClass.com is a teaching and learning system for music teachers and students. You can teach and be taught in a video conference on a website that's private. Go to FetchClass.com for more details. FetchClass.com. Also, I want to let you know about my Amazon affiliate program. Go to Epilogue.ca and you'll see banners on the right side. Those are links to Amazon. If you click on one of those links from the UK or from America or from Canada, bookmark that link. And every time you shop on Amazon, go to that bookmark. You'll be helping the show out and it'll cost you no extra money. Also, I want to let you know about my Patreon campaign. Patreon is a pledging system that allows people to pledge a monthly amount, small, large, whatever it is. Pledge to Epilogue and help the show out by going to patreon.com/epilogue, and you can pledge as little as $1 a month, $2 a month, $4 a month, $5 a month, whatever you want, and you'll be helping the show out with that. Podcasts are free, but it always costs money to do this sort of thing. So if you like what you're doing, kick in something and help me out. Follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. Like the podcast on Facebook by going to facebook.com/epiloguepod. I say it every week. I'd like you to go to iTunes, subscribe, rate, and review the show. Now, I don't know how the voodoo hoodoo of iTunes and how it works, but the more rates and reviews, what I do know is the more rates and reviews you put in, the higher up the list it puts you. So therefore, your exposure to the show is greater because you've been put higher up the list. Does that make sense? There's more visibility on the show. Today on the show, I have an old dear friend, Mr. Scott McCullough. Scott is a founding member of the band The Doughboys. Anybody who knows who The Doughboys are will know of the other band he was in called Rusty. So why don't y'all sit back, relax, enjoy the conversation I had with my friend, Scott McCullough, on the Epilogue Podcast. We are recording.
Hello, are we there?
Yes, we are in an amazing 15th floor apartment building where I'm looking at the CN Tower, I'm looking at the lake, I'm looking at a graveyard, and I'm looking at where the ice storm claimed all of its trees.
Oh, you were on that. Yeah, that's a trip.
That was a couple of years ago.
Glenn Gould's buried in that cemetery.
Get the fuck out, really?
Yeah.
Is he?
He is. I've never seen the site. I walked all through there because it's a real tree farm, but...
Yeah, I bet you'd find it online somewhere.
Yeah, you know, there's quite a few famous people buried for Toronto anyway in there, and there's a map of where they are if you look at go online. Yeah.
Did they bury Glenn Gould with his weird little kitchen chair that he used to play with?
You know, I have no idea because, like I say, I've never actually seen his gravesite. I've seen some other, like, there's a couple of Canadian politicians. I think, is Darcy McGee in there? That's not Montreal. Anyway, I've seen a few, but I haven't seen Glenn Gould for some reason.
It's very cool. I mean, I love the fact that you have a view. Your building feels like you've walked into the set of Mad Men a little bit.
Very 50s. Yeah.
Very 50s.
Live swans in the fountain when they built it.
I was just saying, because there's a bunch of buildings that kind of look like this building and have the same kind of fountain. And I drove in where I thought I was going to be, and it was this old, decrepit, beat-up-looking fountain, and it looks like somebody had gone and dressed it, like, for a set to be the 20 years from now when the bombs hit.
Yeah.
But it's the exact same fountain, only it's all overgrown. And these are, like, nice fountains.
Yeah, these ones they upkeep.
I am here with Scott McCullough, who is a guitar player for many years now, played in The Doughboys, played in Rusty, and you played in bands in between, and you played in bands before.
Yeah.
So let's go back to your early days. Where are you, a Toronto boy?
No, I grew up mostly in Montreal. Spent a few elementary school years in Sarnia.
Okay.
What
gets you going between?
Oh, my dad worked in construction, worked for a construction company that did like chemical and oil stuff. So that's why they would end up in Sarnia, or he would work in New Brunswick. He worked in, you know, managing whatever,
yeah,
whatever horrific fucking thing they were doing in the mill, yeah, polluting the fucking river or whatever. Yeah. So that's why I ended up in Sarnia for a few years, Kingston for a year, but mostly Montreal. Spent, you know, most of my growing up in high school years there. Went to University in Ontario, which kind of got me to Kingston, and then post that I came right to Toronto. So I got here about 83. So I was around the Montreal music scene in the early punk days, but I kind of...
You're young.
Yeah, and then the university years, I was in kind of Kingston, so mm-hmm. there wasn't much there. There was, you know, there was a couple of local bands and stuff like that. Tony Kenny, who ended up in the... What was that band? The Razorbacks. They had a local band.
Yeah, I remember
then.
The Razorbacks, yeah.
They had a band called The Wise Guys during the rockabilly, early, that 80, 81 rockabilly thing.
Yes, I remember the Stray Cats. They kind of fostered that whole thing, didn't they?
Oh, they completely started it. Yeah, yeah. I saw them live in that year in 81, I think, at the Spectrum in Montreal.
Yeah.
So I was going to shows in Montreal a bit. Like, I saw Teenage Head and a bunch of other bands there, but really, I didn't get into the music scene playing till I got here in 83. I guess I was 21. And I was still in a band that I brought from university that we were doing like new wave covers, doing Elvis Costello songs and Teenage Head songs and stuff. And then we got here and we did some gigs, and then we opened for Personality Crisis at Cloquete. And I was like, we did this kind of show and we were playing covers, Cure covers, and they were doing originals. And I was like, okay, screw this. We can't be doing covers anymore. We just got to write songs no matter how shit they are. And that's when I started. That band was called... Big King Corpse with Drew Atkins and Joel Wasson.
Oh, I know Drew. Why do I know Drew?
Drew. Probably through me.
Yeah.
He's true. A bass player. He's played with everyone from Groovy. He's done Sint and the Asexuals, Groovy Religion,
right.
Frank Nevada's, Boneheads, all those bands. Drew's been, he runs a big successful programming company now because he's an engineering guy, but he plays bass with Joel now in his band.
Yeah.
So he's been, you know, and Joel's still playing too. Yeah. We were like a little three-piece, and we were kind of terrible, and our songs were kind of terrible too, but
What was the influence?
I don't know. At the time, we were just like, we were a three-piece band, loud rock. We're trying to write pop songs, wordy pop songs. I mean, I had listened to everything. I was like a true punk rock, first-gen punk rock kid. But I mean, at that time, I think we were trying to ape maybe the Violent Femmes and the Gun Club and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Like, we're closest I can think to what we were actually trying to get at, you know.
Quasi-new wave, but...
Still, like...
No keyboards?
Well, funnily enough, Drew was a keyboard player. And we converted him into a bass player. When we got to Toronto, he had a Rhodes, a Farfisa, and everything. So he was a really good keyboardist.
Tick, tick.
And so we used to haul those fucking things with us. And then for three songs, he'd leave bass and play keyboard. So it would be keyboards, guitar... And drums.
A la Doors,
but not
Farfisa.
Really.
I had one almost cut my finger off because they have that folding, the carriage thing that comes up. And I got one given to me. And I sold it. I sold it like a year ago. And that sucker, I hated it. I put it in the car once. I'm like, screw this. Because I have a plug-in on my computer now. It's called Farfisa.
Oh, man. He built these wooden boxes for these things that were like 20 times heavier than the keyboards built. So moving them was like atrocious. It was just like, why are we even doing this?
Yeah.
But we did.
And you need an amp to play him through, too, right?
The Rhodes has its own amp. Maybe he ran everything through that Rhodes speaker. It's got like a kind of Fendery speaker that sits underneath it. But they were, and he had an old synth, too. Maybe a Moog or something. I don't know. But anyway, it was like... Yeah, and that band lasted like about 83 till about 85, and then we broke up, and I wasn't doing anything, and then John had gotten kicked out of the Asexuals, and he called me up, because I had known him since he was like a little kid in our suburban neighborhood in Montreal. In fact, he used to come, when I first started playing when I was like 13, 14, him and his buddies would come into our basement to watch, and John remembers sitting under the ping pong table, plugging in and out the lamp to make a strobe light effect.
Get that.
And stuff like that. But so he called me, I think second. He got his other high school buddy, Brock Pytel, who was like a metal drummer, who played in like an Alice Cooper cover band. He had a snake. The whole deal, yeah. Brock had a snake. And he called me, and he's like, you know, Asexuals are over. I want to start a new band. You want to move to Montreal? I was like, I wasn't playing with anybody. So I said, yeah, sure. And moved to Montreal. And we started up the Doughboys.
How long was it before you were out on tour with that? Like,
it was fast.
Yeah.
Because
John had an Asexuals connection. Like, his rock and roll connection through the Asexuals would have propelled you guys a little better than starting from scratch.
Plus, John was all the PR of the Asexuals. He booked all their tours.
Yeah.
He did everything that got them their record stuff. So John, you know, always been a manager from day one. So... He things happened really quick. We got the songs together. We did a 3-song demo, a couple of them. One at La Majeure that Brock Pytel re-released. Mm-hmm. And then he got Bill Bavaris from Pipeline to agree to fund the record. And we went to Studio Victor, made it, I think, in the winter of 87. And then we hit the road for 3.5-month American tour. And our record wasn't even out yet. And we just went on tour. And we just got lucky. We did East Coast. And then we got to Florida. And we did a couple of gigs with Henry Rollins, The Descendants, and MIA. And they liked us.
Yeah.
And they put us on the rest of the tour. So we were supposed to be going out for maybe a month. And we ended up on tour for 3.5 months. And we stayed in maybe 5 hotel rooms in 3.5 months. Like, it was a it was a floor sleeping tour, you know.
Bill Stevenson talks about you guys, I can't remember who he talked to about it, but he talks about the Doughboys. He goes, they were in the air constantly jumping.
Yeah
He's like, it was to a fault, like, why are they jumping? What's going on here?
Even before I think once Cummings got there, he, like, we were, it was an old Asexuals thing. They always used to jump around too, so we all adopted it. And it's true, the three of us were like the only pictures of me in that band. I'm flying through the
scared.
Used to jump off Brock's bass drum. But yeah, we were a good live band, and the band was the initial version of that band. I mean, there's many lineups, but it was a cool lineup, the four of us.
Yeah, absolutely. The first version, Brock Pytel, you, Bonhead, and Kastner.
Yeah.
That is a, yeah, that's a, I don't think that's been ever been put back together.
No. I suggested it to John when he did the thing. I was like, hey, let's do an initial lineup thing of some whatever song. But it was, you know, too much trouble. He was already dealing with however many lineups that band went through. But no, we only did the one record because I was gone. I was gone by the end. After that tour ended, my girlfriend had moved to Kingston, so I left to go be with her, and John kicked me out of the band while I was gone, thinking somehow that I wasn't coming back to Montreal, which I was.
Right.
But he got worried about me just not being showing up, so he called William New, and William suggested Jonathan Cummings, and then he called me and said I was out, and I was really disappointed because the first show that I didn't play with the Doughboys was opening for Husker Du at the Spectrum in Montreal. But I had already had this other thing going with my buddy Pat, this band called Luther Victim, that Ian Blurton played drums on most of our tracks. Mm-hmm. And we were kind of a little amateurish, but he was a really good songwriter, and I'd been already doing stuff, recording stuff with him, so I just started playing with him. We got a little interest from Aquarius Records, but nothing really happened with that band because we were just, our business sense was entirely lacking, and it was kind of a dilettante outfit, but we recorded some good stuff.
And that, well, man, that would have been fun, watching Blurton play drums.
Yeah, he plays drums on a lot of the tracks, like from 87 on. He's on all, he's our only drummer of record on all the recordings until 89, 90 before we use somebody else, I think. So
really?
Okay. I have a whole stockpile of them. They're actually sitting up online, stockpiled at luthervictim.com. You can go check them out.
It's cool.
It's like 3 albums worth of material.
No way. Oh, okay, yeah. For sure. So this is probably, we're going fast now. So this is like 89, 88?
Yeah.
And then where are you now? You're in Montreal, you're in Toronto?
Still in Montreal. I think I moved back. I always forget when I moved back to Toronto. I think it's 91 because I was here for both the Jays series wins.
Yeah.
So okay. I arrived back.
What, do you mean the one post-strike as well?
No, didn't they win? 92, 93.
Yeah, when was the strike, though? Because apparently didn't they ended up because they didn't have a World Series.
Well, that was the year the Expos should have been in. That was 94. Was the
okay,
strike.
Okay, yeah. Right.
So I was here by 91, mm-hmm. I think. Yeah.
Okay, well, that's sort of around where Toronto discovered punk rock again, I think, too, right?
Like,
in a way.
Yeah. When I first moved back, I ended up playing bass in the Hubbards. That was the first thing I did. So you know Paul Emery?
I know that name, yeah.
Yeah, he was in the Dandelions.
Yes.
Bill Puddle, the Hubbards. He's got a band now called Paul Emery and the Dickens. He's the guy who owns the Communist Daughter and 3-Speed. He runs bars now. But
okay, yeah.
He's one of Toronto's kind of forgotten good songwriters.
Wow, okay.
And, so I played bass in their band just because I loved their band. And that was the first thing I did. I lived with him. And then I ended up living with Dave Schallenberg from the Jellyfish Babies, that Halifax band.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, I love that band.
Who later died of a heroin overdose. There's a Rusty song about him called DS27, which is his initials and the year, his age when he died.
Yeah. Oh, okay, yeah.
But
I love that band.
Yeah, yeah.
I just brought this back. I'm like, oh my God, I love that band.
Jellyfish Babies. Yeah, well, they were around when there wasn't a ton of Halifax bands. They were early alternative bands.
Yeah, yeah. Very cool.
But yeah, so I was living with him and living with Paul and was playing in the Hubbards. And Kenny lived down the street from me, and I'd known Ken and those guys since the 80s when I was just kicked out of the Doughboys. I came to Toronto, And they won Free Fall. I guess it'd been going for a year or two. Anyway, I met them. And they used to come and visit me when they were in Montreal. They'd stay at my place and stuff or hang out and party when they were in town. So I knew them. And then Ken and I got to be buddies. And I was demoing a bunch of stuff with Luther Victim. We were driving around in his car. And I guess they kicked Sandy Graham out. And he just said, of One Free Fall. And he's like, hey, you know, I just want to start a new band, not the old name. And so I started jamming with him and Bob and Jim Moore. And that's when Rusty started, which had been in like the summer of 94.
Right. So Bob and Ken were in Run Free Fall together. Because Bob was in One Free Fall, wasn't he?
Bob was kind of their hired gun last drummer. They had their longtime drummer was a guy named Jimmy Williams. Mm-hmm. And he, when they went down to L.A. to record the record with Garth Richardson, their first record, Garth was like, your drummer's not good enough. So they got the dude from the Chili Peppers, Chad, whatever. And then Jimmy Williams just hung out at the hotel with a bevy of Japanese women. And then he went home, and he never practiced or tried to get better. Anyway, they ended up replacing him by Bob. But Bob was kind of a drummer for hire. I don't think he was necessarily in the band. He was kind of a paid jobber. And he went, I mean, Bob, after he left Rusty because he was raising a family, he couldn't do the Rusty thing. He ended up playing with Jeff Healy and a bunch of other guys, too.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
So he was around, but it was really, I guess, Jim and Ken were the mainstays, you know.
Where did Jim come from? Where was Jim's...
Well, Jim comes from the same town as Ken in the East Coast, right? They're both from Wolfville, Kempville there. Yeah. But Jim was like the real rock and roll guy. He played in like rockabilly bands growing up. He was a drummer as a kid. Yeah. And then he also played, you know, Dave Porter?
Yes.
Well, he was in Dave Porter had this band called the Misery Goats, I guess. Mm-hmm. And Jim Moore played, I don't know if he played bass or drums, but prior to One Free Fall, he played with Dave Porter in this band, the Misery Goats. And I think they might have toured out west one time. But
Dave is like a prominent A&R guy from our times too.
Yeah,
right?
Now runs a fish farm out in BC.
Get out of here!
Yeah,
whoa, who would have known?
On Facebook.
Who would know you could actually just go from A&R to fish farm?
Yeah. Who would know? Yeah, he's living the grizzled fucking wilderness life out there.
Amazing.
But yeah, so Jim and Ken had known each other growing up, and they had played together. I think Jim taught Ken how to play drums because Ken was originally a drummer too. I think he used to busk with drums on the streets of Toronto when he first got here, like at 18. But he really liked Ken as a singer. I think he saw the band with Ken as a singer and said, I love your front man, Nuss. I want to join this band. So Jim Moore, taught himself to play bass. And so it was those two guys and then whatever drummer. Jimmy Williams was their original drummer. He was also from the Valley. And as it turns out, Bob Vess, even though he was a hired gun, was also, he had his dad, who was a football coach, had taught at Acadia. So he'd also lived in Wolfville as well. So there was that Wolfville connection between all five of them.
Jeez, okay.
Yeah.
Rusty was put together in
94, summer 94.
And that moved fast too.
Oh, yeah. Well, it moved really fast because they already had management in place. Jeff was already managing
the
band. Yeah, yeah. From the One Free Fall days. And, and then he just had the Crash Test Dummies, so he'd made a poop load of money off them. And so he had money to burn, and so it was... As soon as we got going, as soon as we had five songs, we were in the studio recording them.
Yeah.
And those, we liked the demo so much, we released that first EP as is. Mm-hmm. And then Wake Me went immediately to radio. Became like a minor Toronto hit before it spread out. And we made a video. And then it got played on 120 Minutes in the States. And then the shit hit the fan. And we had every record company in America whining and dining us. So yeah, things moved. Well, compared to all of us who've played in independent bands all our lives, it was like, it was ridiculous how fast things happened, you know?
I was on tour around that time with Dave Reese from SNFU.
Yeah, I know him well.
And he would tell stories like, he'd see you on TV and go, holy crap!
It's Scotty!
Yeah. He told me a story once where you kicked a beer can across the street at St. Catherine, going to the Buff Tech, and just hucked this beer bottle, maybe a beer bottle.
I think I threw it instead of kicked it, but maybe.
And it just barely almost hit somebody, and it's like, you were a bit of a wild man back then, huh?
Yeah, Pat told me that story too, was horrified by it. Pat, who's done a lot of bad things in his life as well, but yeah, I was certainly, I was known for getting out of hand, that's for sure.
Yeah, a lot of drinking.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fair bit of drinking, a lot of drug taking.
Yeah.
Definitely. I was like, I'm sure half the people you meet, if you ask them about Scotty, they'll say, oh, he's crazy.
Yeah. But the funny thing is I've had many great band conversations with you that have always been enlightening. So there's a lot of people that get brain damage from drugs, and it seems like it didn't really affect you, you know? Like,
no, surprisingly not. I guess I'm, you know...
Were you really smart before drugs, and now you're just quasi-smart?
I was a little brainiac kid, so maybe I had a little more to begin with. I had more to shave off the top.
Yeah, like those donaires at the... You know, you're just shaving that brain cell off.
I still had some mass left. I mean, yeah. I mean, obviously it doesn't help. I'm a bit of a forgetful guy now, but yeah. I mean, you know...
We all are. I was trying to remember. I remembered a time, though, because I was talking about to you this before, months ago, where I thought all four original Doughboys were in my house, but you were there the week after Pytel came in with John and Bonhead. So I put you in the same studio for some reason.
Right.
So I have to re-edit myself because it's you were the week after you and your buddy came to my studio, my house.
Oh, was that when me and Ken came with Pat? And did those recordings that we never found?
Never. Yeah, I couldn't even find it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I was probably the craziest in the Doughboys days.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, you know, I was always... I mean, I didn't get into music to do crazy stuff. I was always into the music and stuff. Yeah. But I'm a bit of a... But see, you put too much liquor in me and I do funny stuff, you know?
Well, I mean...
I'll certainly give you a pack load of stories anyway.
Well, yeah. I mean, the whole idea... I loved... There's a story I hear about Brock when he went quiet and he refused to talk.
Yeah. That's after I was gone.
Was that after you were gone?
Yeah.
Okay. We won't go there.
The only thing I can tell you about Brock is that, well, before we left on that Doughboys tour, one night we all did acid at my place in Montreal. And we woke up the next day... And Brock had a conversation with the cat while we were sleeping. And we had one of those old Montreal burners and we had a jacket on it and it had caught on fire.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he had put it out, but he had said he had seen the person that lived in the jacket before. And it was like an old military jacket from the 1800s.
Oh, sure.
Anyway, the next day he stopped eating meat, stopped drinking beer, stopped smoking cigarettes, and stopped taking drugs.
No way.
The next day.
Wow.
And then we went on tour.
Okay.
And So the Brock that I had been living with, because he was my roommate, was different than the Brock we went on tour with. And I think that progressed. He got into Buddhism and he got into silence.
Sure.
But during that tour, all of a sudden, you know, and he would walk around in bare feet. Like, for instance, we got to New York City and he wouldn't wear shoes. Mm-hmm. And it was like he walked around New York City for like 2 days in bare feet. I mean, just in this New York City in the 80s.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah,
I mean,
yeah. Needles.
Poke your fucking foot with a syringe. New York, Lower East Side.
Wow.
But that was Brock, you know. He was just very... very kind of spiritual guy, kind of looking for something. And of course, it never hurts anyone stopping drinking and taking drugs, right? He was the better for it. So.
It's funny how, it's funny how one night of talking to a cat can completely change your life forever.
One night, he just took a left turn. Like,
that's amazing.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I would have loved to have been able to record that conversation with that cat.
I was asleep for that. Now, we woke up the next day and Brock heard the stories. Well, there had been a minor fire in the apartment as well.
Yeah.
It was one of those old Montreal weird Peter things that's just in the middle of the room. And
oh, my gosh.
Someone left the jacket on top. It hadn't turned out bad. Maybe it smoked a bit, but still, you know.
Yeah, when we're talking about drugs and stuff like that, I mean, it's funny how I know a lot of people who have sort of come up the back end of it. And it's always sort of a cautionary tale about drugs and how bad it was and stuff like that. But it's a lot of fun, I bet, in times.
Well, I mean, it's both, you know. It's fun and not fun, too. I mean, I got pretty deeply into drugs. Like, I never shot drugs, but I became a heroin addict. And I was smoking crack. I mean, that was pretty bad, especially during the 90s. Mm-hmm. I mean, I ground myself right into homelessness, basically. You know. So there's a lot of people I know who just didn't stop. You know, they just keep going. And I'm amazed. The weird thing is I always think people think, well, you know, those people just die. Well, a lot of them don't. But like Keith Richards, there's a lot of really bad drug addicts. I still know they're still chugging along. And I'm kind of like, how do they do it? Because I just couldn't keep that kind of shit up forever. I had to stop.
You break.
I went to rehab and I was like, you know. Yeah. I had to stop. I was like, I can't do this.
Believe me, I'm jealous of every one of those people who have that those constitutions of like fucking elephants.
I know.
They can just take it.
It amazes me, and it amazes me they're still ticking. Like I say, I don't have that kind of constitution. Like, I still drink a bit and smoke weed and stuff, but I just don't do the kind of stuff I used to do, and I just don't think I can. I don't have one of those. I have a pretty good constitution, but I don't have that kind of constitution.
What about triggers? Anything trigger you? Sitting on a porch, talking in a mic.
You know, nothing really triggers me except the thing itself. You know, if I have one beer, I probably still want to have 10.
Yeah. Well, but, you know, we're all there. You know, that happens. It has to be the right time. You know, you know, there's a lot of people who drink every day and are drunks. But there's also that, it seems like the moon's aligned where it's time to drink. I'm okay with that.
Yeah, I'm pretty mellow these days, although I can still have a tendency to occasionally drink too much, but that gets less and less. And I kind of take breaks, too. I'm just like, enough of that and need a break. And then, okay, break's over.
Well, you shouldn't really, I mean, if you have a problem with drinking and drugs, you should never put a limit saying, I will never do this, I think. I will never drink again. Because now you've put a lot of pressure.
Well, I do know some people who it's like, because I traveled through that rehab world and all that kind of stuff, and I saw people who are like, they're the real fucking the Bill W. AA alcoholic kind of things. Yeah. Like they put that first drop in and then they could go for 49 days. And I've seen people withdraw from alcohol where it's like they're shaking like heroin addicts. I never reached those kind of points, but there's people who should be never. Mm-hmm. And then there's the vast majority of other people who's like, well, maybe it wouldn't be such a good idea for you to, But yeah, I mean, I agree. Some people shouldn't do it. And, you're going to be more productive if you don't, I think. But I'm not really, I don't really have a, kind of be all or end all on it.
A rule, you never, yeah.
Yeah, you. I mean, yeah. I think it's kind of way more individual. And I really don't buy into the whole 12-step things. I find it just a pile of nonsense. Yeah. So the people who get sober that way, I'm fine with them doing it that way, but it's just a very difficult place for me to inhabit.
It's pretty godly, isn't it?
It's very godly, yeah.
Well, and if you have a problem with... I mean, a lot of people who are at that edge, they'll turn to anything. Doesn't matter, like, oh, thank God, I'm not doing this anymore, so... But if you have that, if you don't hit that bottom that says, oh, I need something, I've interviewed people who were born again, and I don't have a problem with the religion part of it. I think if it makes you happy, if it makes you not go to a clock tower, I'm okay with that.
Yeah.
But the whole idea of like, yeah, there was, because my
this is the only way you can recover. Yeah.
It's exactly.
Like, there's no rational scientific way to recover. It's like, wait a second.
Yeah.
And it was especially troubling is that all the government money or anything you do, they funnel you into that system because that's all they know.
Sure.
So you've got the Ministry of Health basically sending you, even though they don't couch it that way, they're basically sending you to a religious organization to get better. Yeah. And really, in this day and age, there's got to be at least a choice.
Well, drugs, other countries in Europe have basically taken over the lead about how to get people off of drugs. And some people just need it. And methadone is the worst thing you can give a heroin addict because it's worse and it's longer.
Yeah, so, I did methadone for a few years. So.
Yeah.
I got off it, though. Most people don't want to get off it, whereas I got my doctor to drop my dose bit by bit. I mean, it worked for me, but some people never want to leave it because you are on an opiate. Hitler invented opiate.
Yeah.
But
I knew he was wrong for something. Hitler.
I think we cut off their opium supplies in World War II, so their scientists invented the longest lasting opioid known to man.
He was on it too, wasn't he?
I don't know. I don't know. But it came from the Nazis.
Oh, fucking still Nazis. God damn it. Ruin a mustache. And invent the dope drugs that gets everybody. He wins in the end, right? Like, what's going to happen.
Now all the hipsters have his haircut.
That's right. And go to East Hastings, right? And look up by East Hastings and by Gastown and all the zombies that are high on opiates. That's Hitler's fault.
It is Hitler's fault. Hitler, there's a lot of things that are Hitler's fault.
Fucking Hitler.
I'm blaming him for junkies and hipsters.
Mustache.
Even some of them have the mustache.
Yeah, like, get the fuck out of
you
here.
You got the haircut. You're not going to wear the mustache, are you?
That's taking it too far, hipsters.
It is the haircut.
I'm sorry.
Though. It is the Hitler haircut, I swear.
It is.
Shave size down, flipped over on the side, longer on top.
Well, that was sort of like an English page boy, too. There used to be like that English page boy thing where it was like the Tony Hawk. Like a longer version of the Tony Hawk was like an English page boy haircut, but... How do we get the Hitler?
I don't know. Hipsters and Hitler. They sound the same. They got the same haircuts.
Hi, hipsters. Oh, man.
Speaking of Hitler, here's a funny fact. John is part Jewish, not completely.
Yeah.
The name of his first band when he was a kid in Montreal, and his dad must have been really pleased with this. His first punk band for the Asexuals, they were called Johnny Jew and the Holocaust. I kid you not, John Kastner will confirm that for you.
How old was he?
They were kids. They were the Asexuals were kids. So the Asexuals put their first record out 17, 18. He had to be 15 or 16. I mean, that's your 15 or 16 year old suburban punk John Kastner. What's going to piss off my parents the most?
Oh my God.
I'm actually Jewish and I'm going to call my band name this.
You know? Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, how do you get across the border? That's the question.
They never, this was before they ever did any traveling. But you got to give them credit for having the parents pissing off balls to do that.
Oh my God. Yeah. Kudos. How about his band that he manages, Gateway Drugs? I always thought, how did he get across the border? He must have to have an alter ego name to get into Canada.
Yeah. You know, they're all the kids of the Knack
bass player.
Doug Inglis, I think his name is. Yeah, three of them. And I saw all their shows at Canadian Music. I kind of really liked them. They were good. That drummer is killer.
He is awesome. Yeah. It took me a little while to get into it because I was like, this is too loud. But I think with a little bit of coercing and a bigger stage, they are going to be massive, huge.
Yeah. They're young too, right? Yeah. So they got some, they look pretty good for their age. I mean,
they're kind of like new age noise rock, right? Like that's their thing, right? And they're kind of doing it better than all the other noise rock bands that are out there now.
Yeah. So no, I like them. I like the heck out of them. They were good.
Yeah. And good people too.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah, I hung out with those kids all week.
Really nice. Yeah. Yeah. Really. Yeah. So what are you doing these days? What's going on?
Well, you know, you've done a little Rusty Travels with us.
Oh, really, Rusty? So, yeah, Rusty got back together, right? Is it back together, or is it sort of like a probationary period of sorts?
Well, we did that thing in 2011. We did the reunion deal that John booked us for at North by Northeast.
I was there.
Yeah, and then we just kind of carried. Jim went back to the UK, saw Johnny Sutton playing with Arson, and thought, well, we need a bass player. Mm-hmm. Invited him to join. We switched drummers again because John Lally couldn't do something, so Bob came back in.
He's too busy kite surfing.
He was kite surfing down in Aruba or something.
Yeah.
and so we would do like a handful of shows every year. You know, yeah. We'd do some Christmas stuff, no more than five or six dates a year because Ken's living in Sudbury with a big family down here in Toronto. So it's a bit hard logistically to get stuff together. And I keep on saying, oh, we got to write some new songs and do some new material.
Yeah.
And we hadn't done that in, just over the last little while. John Kastner, my old Doughboys mate, offered to manage us because he's got a management company down in L.A. now. We just went in the studio last weekend. He booked us something with Tom Darcy, and we got in. We laid two songs down, pretty well wrote them in the studio. Mm-hmm. Those guys and I rehearsed.
Kind of what you always did.
Sort of. We only really did that on our last record, but I kind of been playing with Lally, and I had been playing with Rob, so I had kind of had a bunch of I've been writing ever since Rusty broke up and recording stuff, so I got tons of material. So we just pulled out some riffs, taught them to Sutton, and ran through them a few times, took them in the studio, laid them down on tape, and Ken threw some vocals onto them, and actually I'll play them for him when we're done.
Yeah.
And so we got a couple songs, and the idea is to get some Factor money, put a record out, and maybe at least next year when it comes to playing, we can maybe do some with new material, we can maybe do some cool festivals. I think John wants us to play with the Lemonheads down in Boston and New York and just do some bigger stuff than what we're doing, which is basically horseshoe shows and Call the Office and a couple of other, the small town, the Ontario circuit, which is fine by us. All our shows are fun and old fans come out and that they're supportive, so they're enjoyable. But after a couple years of doing this, I mean, if you're a musician, like I know we're now an oldies band. Like it's our fans are listening.
Well, 90s is the new thing now, man.
Three records, that we did. But I mean, from a musician's perspective, you get bored just playing old material, which I guess we did at the time. But when
BTO always needs to play Taking Care of Business.
Yeah.
Always.
Yeah. I mean, and we'll do the songs people want to hear, but it's really nice to, and maybe the new ones people will turn their nose up at. But for our perspective, we need some new material just to make it a little more fun.
Sure. You know? The whole fact is then you're not becoming a nostalgia band anymore. You're actually putting something in. And I think the nostalgia thing would grow tired after a while.
Yeah, unless you're already tired of it.
Unless you're the Stones. And then the Stones could be nostalgia until they all die.
Yeah.
But
they have a larger selection of stuff to pick from.
Well, they have different nostalgias too. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So that my point was that there's...
With only three albums and, a number song, we needed to write some new stuff. Mm-hmm. And so it's ongoing now. We started, so we'll see where it takes us.
Yeah, well, I hope that
maybe we'll be visiting your studio.
Maybe. Who said? I told you I was a quasi bit jealous when I'm like, gone to Darcy? Is Tom Darcy? What the? How dare he?
John set that up.
Yeah.
It was kind of fast and
John
fast
Kastner,
and cheap. Fast, dirty, and cheap.
Yeah.
But it was good. It got us in there and started, which
it's
was
a good
really
studio.
What happened we needed to do.
Yeah.
And now we've got it into our head that maybe every month, okay, yeah, I'll come down from Sudbury.
Yeah.
We'll knock out a couple more tracks. So it was good to get us started, and we'll see where it ends up.
In all honesty, Tom Darcy is a solid dude. One thing I gave him credit for is when you text him, he texts you back.
Right.
There's this thing going on in society now where people don't get back to you. and I feel that people need to immediately return their phone calls or immediately return their messages, because then you're validating that person. Because we're in this society now where people are instantly, you know, texting and this and that, and you're good for it too. You're good at it too, because it's like when I get a hold of you, you just return the call.
Yeah, yeah.
Or there's an ethic that's lost on some people where you just need to return. As a tour manager, it's impossible texting someone and saying, I need this information.
And don't get it.
Yeah. Don't get it. I'm not calling you because I want to see how your kids are doing. I'm texting you because I need this fucking information.
Yeah. And you kind of know, since everyone's on their phone, if you're not hearing back from them, they're willfully ignoring you. You know that.
Exactly. Basically. And then there's a thing that says delivered now. Like, you can't get away.
Yeah.
Do you red. Remember?
Yeah, it's been red.
Red. Even worse. Delivered then red. And then you need the little really thing that they're replying. But remember there used to be a thing in email that used to say, click this button to send a message back saying that you've read the message.
Oh, yeah.
I wonder
vaguely
if that
do.
Still exists. Because I haven't really looked for it, but it just popped in my head now.
Maybe if you use Outlook or something. I mean, I've used Gmail, but maybe...
I think it was Outlook. We used to say, have you read this message? And then it would send you a confirmation that, yes, I've read the message. We need to bring that back. Because there's a lot of people say, oh, I didn't get your email. Like, bullshit. You didn't get
I remember when I was doing that for business, when I was working in Montreal selling high-tech stuff. I remember... I was selling
drugs.
No, computers. So it was like work for a company called Insight that sold they're a Fortune 500.
Insight.
They do business.
Oh, Inside.
Okay. Insight.
Oh, they stole my fucking name.
Might have had it before you.
God damn it.
Okay. Anyway, I was dealing with I used to sell computers and servers and everything to the Major League Baseball Advanced Media Office in New York and stuff like that. It's they're a Fortune 500 company anyway, and it was like that. There was a thing on that where they would. You could verify that your emails had been read, because it was like you were doing these, $500,000 deals, and you were sending emails back and forth, and people were busy, but you needed to know that someone had freaking read it, seen the quote, or done whatever, right?
You know? Because then they can just dog you forever, saying, I'll get to it.
Yeah.
And they probably already have. Yeah.
Whereas phones were a bit more dodgy. You'd spend a lot of time playing telephone tag, but at least with emails, you could kind of... They would dodge phone calls, but they would respond to emails.
Yeah. touring back in the day, too, before pre-email, pre-cell phones.
I can't even figure out how we did it.
It was a lot of... You remember that big map book you'd get at the first Husky stop or whatever? It'd be the big map book.
I guess you had to advance all the shows from hotel rooms.
Or phone... We used to use stolen phone cards.
Oh, the phone cards. Yeah. I remember that. I used to call... On that first Doughboys tour, I called my parents more than I did when I was in Montreal, because I'd just be in some city and I'd be a little lonely or something. I'd be I'm just gonna... And I had these phone cards from whoever did that tour, Johnny somebody. And we just had those endless phone numbers. And every 3 days, I'd be like, hey, Mom. Hey, Dad. Yeah. Where are you? Oh, I'm in San Francisco. Oh, I'm in Miami.
We used to use this scam where a friend of ours worked at a hotel. And he had an 800 number. So we'd call the 800 number, and then he would be able to man the switchboard, call out, and connect the two phone calls. So we would book whole tours from the road calling this hotel in Winnipeg. And then he would then patch us through and then connect us to the club that was probably down the road.
Yeah.
It was a pretty good scam. I remember back in the old days going to phone booths with a stolen phone card. How does this work? You just dial it in and had 4 hour conversations. And
yeah. Brutal. I remember when on that same Doughboys tour, I came out of took a bus. I left the tour and took a bus from Kansas City to Los Angeles because I was hanging out with this girl that I met, and John got really mad at me, but we didn't have a show for 10 days. So I showed up for the next show in LA. But I remember getting out of the bus station in LA, and the first thing I did, there was all these dudes, and they were like, you want to call home? You want to call home? And I hadn't seen that where they were actually selling them on the street.
Oh, yeah,
it was
you
gave them a couple bucks, and they gave you a phone number that was going to be good for an hour because it was going to get burned until,
Well, people used to just go into other people's mailboxes and steal their phone cards. And I remember one got mailed to me in Winnipeg, when I lived in Winnipeg, and I'd call the band that mailed it to me, and that was my connection now to them.
Right.
So it's I go to a phone booth, talk to you tomorrow, and I was doing sound for this band, and I would... go to the phone. Don't use it from your house. You're retarded if you use it from your house. So you go to a phone booth and you call, and it's a Bell calling card, like a legit one. And I don't think these people, obviously, if it's stolen out of their mailbox, they
even
don't
know it exists
for
really.
Weeks.
Yeah.
So you'd have a phone card, and then eventually one day it would go. And
yeah, they didn't last very long, but yeah, we used them. Yeah, I was thinking that's what we used in 87.
Yeah.
And then hotel rooms when we were more legitimate, and then I guess cell phones finally arrived. Although, I remember cell phones still in the rusty days being a bit of a...
Expensive?
Or being a bit of a novelty still.
Yeah.
Like Ken had, or Tozer had one, or someone had one, but it was kind of like still a novelty.
Yeah, I remember...
Hey, I'm just going to grab a smoke.
Yeah, go. Smoking on the balcony.
You're no longer a smoker.
No, man. I quit that. I feel good. Speaking about cold turkey. Yeah.
That's got to be the hardest one.
It is a hard one, huh? What are cigarettes costing now these days for a 20-pack?
Down here, they're cheap. They're about $8, I think. You can get illegals for $30 a carton, which I occasionally do, but mostly I still pay the big price. I should quit, too, but shall see.
Well, the next brand is like, what, a Demoreau generic, isn't it? Isn't that how that
they're
works?
Just a cheaper... Now they have cheaper brands and a more expensive brand. Now there's... price differences between smokes.
Yeah.
So Demoreaux's are $13 and those are $10, you know?
Yeah, you know what? I don't miss it. I've got the money. I can buy stuff now. I bought a car, you know?
Well, I'm poor as shit, so for me to smoke is totally makes no sense because I spend probably an inordinate amount of
pack
money.
Pack a day?
Yeah.
Fuck. Yeah, that's $300 plus a month.
Yeah, well, if you just 10 times 7, 71 for... Yeah, exactly. It's like about... half what I pay in rent.
Yeah. So. How is it here? Are you living here?
This is one of my locations.
Yeah.
I have multiple locations. No, I mostly have a studio down at King & Bathurst.
Okay.
In that old coffin factory building there.
Okay, yeah.
But this is my home away from home.
It's your vacation home.
Yeah.
Yeah.
My ex-girlfriend lives here, and I take care of her place when she's up at the country place. So.
Okay, yeah. I always thought that was an interesting relationship between you guys, because... You're obviously not dating, but you seem like so perfect. I don't know why. It just seems like
we're old pals. We're best friends, that's for sure.
Yeah. Well, that's good. I mean, classy lady is Georgie. She's a classy lady.
Yeah. That'll get you far.
Yeah, she's a classy lady. Yeah, man. So, yeah, new Rusty. This is cool. Are you going to just self-release it? There's no plans, I guess, right now.
No plans, but John's obviously the man, so it could come out on Cobra Side, I guess, but I think he shops his bands around to labels and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I'm thinking if we do get a U.S. label release, our old publishing contract, we got some money coming our way if we release in the U.S. and we're still bound to our publisher.
Really?
Although EMI got sold to Sony ATV. Yeah. But as far as I know, we're still under contract. And as I remember correctly, they got to give us $50,000 U.S. if we release a record in the States. So I'm hoping that happens.
Who needs Factor?
Yeah. Who needs Factor?
Yeah.
But I don't know what's going to happen record-wise. And I think we're going to actually, have a website now. We're going to possibly re-release the old records. I think John's negotiating with Jeff. We'll see what happens on that front. Maybe we'll repackage them. I don't think so. Probably just leave them as is and maybe put a few out in vinyl or something.
Sure.
But all those plans are kind of in the works and at least give a spot where people can get merch and stuff like that. So the band is kind of at least in a more ongoing... We're not just doing one-off gigs and stuff.
Yeah. Well, there's got to be a time where it's sort of like, now we just either take this serious or we just don't do it.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
So, yeah, and that's... I'm glad that there's something being done, and everybody's getting a little bit older, and the kids are getting older as well, and so the responsibility, especially for Ken's side to...
Ken, yeah, he's a very busy man. He's tough.
He's a hockey dad.
Yeah, it's toughest of him for all to do it. Plus, he doesn't live in the city, right? He's up in Sudbury. So for him to do it, it's the most difficult time-wise. But he manages to make the time. He figures it out. Like, they're going to do another session in early November. He even wants to kind of put off doing any gigs till we get something done. I wouldn't mind doing a gig before the year goes out. But just the Toronto show. But And then also, too, now that we're hooked up with John, I have reams of old material with Luther Victim and everything else just archived. And I wouldn't mind putting out some of the stuff because that's just sitting there.
It needs to
see. It's all recorded and done. Everything just needs to be mastered. So there's that too. There's all kinds of, there's tons of old stuff. Not so much Rusty, but my own stuff that I wouldn't mind throwing out there. And
sure.
Just, I don't really care. I just like to get it out, you know.
Old is new again. It's coming that circle again now where 90s stuff is now becoming not cool. I don't want to say cool, but relevant. I don't know why, with where we're all sitting with, you know, everybody's getting sick of hipsters. We're all sick of that. What do they listen to? What do hipsters listen to?
I got no idea.
Anything, right? Anything with irony attached to it, right?
Anything, like, that Pitchfork says they can listen to. Yeah.
Anything with, like, you know, you can throw an axe to. If you can throw an axe to it.
Axe throwing music. I'm bad with new. I don't listen to a ton of music, period. Hmm. And so not a lot of new music either.
There's not a lot of new music that would.
I'm bad for that kind of stuff. Like, who do I like nowadays? I like weird music. I like D'Antwoord. Mm-hmm. I like, and they're not even musically that great. I just like their videos and their live shows. You know, I just don't, I'm not really musically in the know. You know, and I spent so many years being like on top of everything. It's just a little tiring, frankly. Well, I'm on top of TV now.
Everything is fast in the music, you know. There's a statistic out there with how many singles are released per month, and it's out of this world. Out of this world how many songs that are on the radio and how much rotation and how fast people are wanting new music. And
just how many more people make music now because it's so easy to make recording, easier to make recording. So it's funny how there was always only a handful of bands really at any given time. And now there is a critical mass of just a ton of people doing shit. So
I think there always was that moving train of music in, music out. But bands like Nirvana went, there you go. Bands made a statement, like even Led Zeppelin, bam, there you go, there's that, and that's going to change everything. Nirvana, bam, there you go, you know, things that just made the world stop a little bit and cross over all the age groups and all the politics and just went, we love Green Day, we love Nirvana, you know, we need that again. We haven't really gotten that. I don't think
there's been a lot of and I mean, I'm kind of not a great lover of the Toronto scene past the 90s. I don't want to get into specifics and start dissing bands like we used to do when we were in the rusty days, but you know, I went to one now concert of the year. Well, they called it concert of the year in the mid 2000s down at Harborfront. We'll just leave that band unnamed. And I thought, they called it the concert of the year, and I thought, this is the most turgid pile of shit I've ever heard in my life. I left after five songs because the tempo didn't change from one song to the next.
It was just bad.
Like, you know, so there's some Toronto bands I do like, but, you know, I kind of feel like the 90s was a better time for music in Toronto then.
You're right. You know, and
sounds like an old man thing to say,
that's
though.
What I was going to say. I'm feeling that there's got to be a scene out there, because I remember when I sort of left the scene for to work for music bands between like 95 and 2001, and I started playing music again. I came back and we played an all ages show, and I didn't know there was an all ages scene. And there was like 200 kids at a show that are come to see an all ages show.
Yeah.
I thought, wow, how did this, who fostered this?
You know, that being said, there are some young bands that I do like just because I happen to catch them. There's a band that we play with from Sudbury, two brothers, Lightmares.
Yeah.
Like those guys. There's a band, I think, from Clinton. I think they moved to Toronto now, called the DeForesters, who are like young, kind of not hardcore, but punk rock, sing along, clashy style band that I really like. I miss them at the Horseshoe. They just played there recently, but I dig those guys. Like, I do hear stuff that I like.
But it has a genre attached to it.
Yeah.
That's what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, there, I mean, all music always sort of does. I've always kind of hated genre.
Yeah.
I'm the last person to stick genre on people, but, you know, if it's fast and messy and loud, I'm just going to default to punk rock, call it punk rock. But
sure.
I kind of, genres irritate me a lot for some reason. I don't know. It, like Jim Moore said, well, I remember once in an interview, Jim Moore's like, what kind of music do you guys play? And he goes, it's that music, that 4/4 beat music that I think was invented in the mid-50s. They called it rock and roll. You know, it's not great. Except for hip-hop, nothing's really fallen out of the prints. No one's playing jazz rock with funny time signatures. Like, you know, we're still playing the same four on the floor kind of junk we always have. It's not like music has really changed that much.
Sure. There needs to be something that's on a different level that people can... Because obviously when popular music is popular, it people relate to it in a certain way, hence its popularity.
Yeah.
So if you say, I love Rusty so much because it spoke to me when I was this person, and now I can be that person again. It's not anything to do with music at this point. It's how you feel about what's being put to you. And the idea that I love this style of music, or I love what it makes me feel like, that's kind of what's going to change the musical direction. I think that's it always has.
Yeah.
You know, whether it's Taylor Swift or it's, I don't know, name any band from today. They need to be able to sort of say, okay, well, I'm speaking to a large audience. And how do you engineer that? And you never can. There's never an answer. How did you make that happen? Why did Nirvana become Nirvana? Well, there's not just because they were a good band. There were so many other things in play. Everybody was sick and tired of Guns N' Roses. People didn't like hair metal anymore. They spoke against everything. All those people that got the shit kicked out of them in high school were now, oh, there's a voice for me.
Yeah.
Where does music enter that? You know what I mean? Like, so.
Well, now, the only modern comparison you would have was, you know, God creating Kanye.
Yeah, that's true.
Because God says Kanye's the man, so.
That's, what's his kid's name? What's the new, they have a new kid?
Jesus, I think.
That is a big... That's a lot against that kid. I'd call him, you know, not Jesus. I'd call him Norm.
Norm. Norm West.
Norm. Just Norm. Al.
Just Norm.
Norm. You know, and then you lower the bar. You can do whatever you want and then become popular and then your name's Norm.
Occasionally, yeah, God creates a band that we need to listen to. Yeah.
God does. We need to, and you know, how do you create that? How do you make that formula? You can't. It's just this weird little stew, you know? You're making stew. You're making food, and you throw some stuff in there, and then it tastes horrible or tastes delicious.
I don't even really get how music works now. I know no one really buys it, so it's amazing that the infrastructure still exists to put it out somehow. Sure. I don't quite even get how the whole thing works. I guess largely the same way it always did, but on a lesser grand scale of money somehow. Although I guess the big artists still... make lots of money
through
various ways.
Yeah, they'll tour into cross promotions with Sprint, you know, and then, you know, get
and if you get $100 million Spotify hits, I guess they will pay you $40,000.
YouTube is, what is it? A million hits gives you $1,000.
Does it?
Something like that. Right. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, yeah, there's obviously ways. It's just, I guess physically selling records is not the way you're going to do it. But I'm kind of wonder how. That's what I thought about those first two demos we did. I just fucking throw them out on the internet right now. Like, maybe everyone will get mad at me for doing that.
Yeah, they will.
But ultimately, it's like, it's so like that, you know? It's just like, might as well have it.
I think.
There you go.
I'm gonna throw this out there. The idea of live music is really important to people, right? But they're too busy to go down the road to the Horseshoe to see a show at the Horseshoe. So why don't we just reinvent how music is brought to people? You know, everybody's got nice TVs. Everybody's got Apple TVs. Pay-per-view streaming. $1. And Rusty will play at somewhere in a studio. It'll sound amazing. And just stream it out.
True. Charge $1. People still go to shows. When we play the Horseshoe, it's sold out every time. And,
yeah,
you know,
but that's because it's a happening. Because they don't know if Rusty's coming back next year.
And big, you know, big festivals aren't suffering for people these days and stuff like that. Although the festival scene has also gotten
it's
to the point where... It's like, it's just...
It's creepy.
Festivals just get too big and go too long, you know? It was like that first Riot Fest. It was like, great, because the Mats and the Stooges were playing it.
Yeah.
And I went, and it was at Fort York, and then it moved up to Downsview, and I'm thinking, I'm not going up there and fucking drive. You know, it's just like... And some of the larger festivals in the States and in England and stuff like that, they just... although the one that I kind of still didn't mind the last time I saw it, but that was way back in 2010, was... Oceaga, because it had a bit of a different vibe being on the island. It wasn't as crowded.
Mm-hmm.
But now I think it's probably reached its critical mass as well. So
if you have any sort of... A friend of mine I used to work with, he goes to bluegrass festivals and became now a fan of bluegrass because of the scene.
Right.
Because you can go from a 1,000-person festival to a 10,000-person festival, and they still feel the same.
Yeah.
They still feel like a little loosey-goosey, what's going to happen, anything can happen.
I'm sure Mariposa is a little bit like that.
Yeah.
You know, it's still up in Orillia, you know, you camp by the lake.
Yeah.
It's got folky kind of feel.
I worked one for a band at the Booth and Hearts, and it was like...
Was all right?
Ugh.
No. There you go.
No, it was just horrible. I don't know how people... could put up with. It was like Molson Park. Remember Molson Park shows?
Right.
Remember how awesome it was to not be in with all the people?
Yeah.
I never went to a Molson Park show after I worked one show because it was like, this sucks.
Yeah.
I feel like you're in a prison camp.
I think I went to one, though, earlier. Well, just after they switched it back up to earlier, that wasn't bad, that Gordon Lightfoot was playing at.
Mariposa?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Well, Mariposa's always been pretty... Yeah, I worked a few of those when I was in my teens.
It's pretty mellow.
Yeah. Pretty mellow, but the whole Boots and Hearts thing is that new bro country, and it's sort of like people aren't there for the music. They're there to party.
Right.
They're there to get a fucking drink on. You know, literally.
Out for a rip.
Out for a little bit of crazy and a little bit of hazy, and everything's all little in country music. It's always little. You know, why don't we invent a new type of music? This is a lot. A lot. I'm into a lot of partying.
That's the Rusty motto. Lots. Lots of punches.
Loud.
Yeah.
Fluke. Just.
It was recorded loud, too. It wasn't like we did everything loud. And, you know, we get, well, I mean, you're a sound man, too, so you know, but I've heard it so many times, but I, you know, it's like Kenny's like, yeah, he might turn it down for sound check, but it's fucking coming right back up as soon as we hit the stage.
Definitely, yeah.
I have a thing with volume, like, and I look at pictures of the Stooges or the MC5 or Jimi Hendrix, and I see those walls on Marshalls. Tell me those fuckers aren't playing loud. Mm-hmm. Like, I have a thing where it's like, I can't really play rock and roll at a muted volume. I need to feel like the spinal electricity charge.
Yeah.
I need to hear the thud and feel the rip. And I have a hard time playing. I don't like playing not at a loud volume.
Well, I have to agree with you there, because I was, for the past 15 years of my guitar playing career, I was always cautious of what the sound man was going through, because I am a sound man.
Yeah.
But the last couple of shows I've played, I didn't care about that. I just cared about, and you're right, it feels awesome, because wow, I can hear myself. Or there's obviously a vibe, because it makes everybody play just a little bit harder, makes everybody sing a little bit louder, and it's not so controlled.
Yeah.
You know, and that is the bonus and benefit part of not having ear monitors and things like that, is that you feel it. Now, it's a sound man's nightmare. The next one that would go on top of that is put a drummer on a, put him on a mic, have him sing. Now, we're talking nightmare.
Yeah.
You know, because it's...
Well, I mean, I play so loud that honestly, I could never truly hear myself out of the monitors. Luckily, I sort of know, kind of half-ass what I'm doing.
Sure.
And I can see, if I can hear it outside of my head slightly, I'm okay. And I'm, you know, I sort of know where I'm going. I'm not just improvising.
Yeah.
But it's a pain in the ass not to be able to hear what you're singing. But honestly, I don't like playing any other way.
Just stick one here, ear plug in your ear and your ear.
Never
off.
Used earplugs. Either.
Really? Just one, just so for pitching. I'd always put the one on the inside. Say if I'm on the right side of the stage, facing out, I would put one on my left ear.
Right.
And then that way I got something to block that, and I got my, you know, and then you got one thing to listen to, you know.
Yeah.
It's easy. It sucks when the next, when you're trying to sleep, because one ear is kind of baffled and the other one's going, whoa!
Right. Yeah, I'm sure I have some hearing damage, although nothing that's, you know, nothing that's obvious, but mm-hmm. you would think there'd be something there,
mm-hmm.
but I don't really know.
Well, I'm really looking forward to this Rusty thing. I am. This is going to be, I think it's going to be fun. You're going to have a good time with this, and...
I think it's going to be good, too. We, you know, we always wrote good songs, and I think we're not going to write... I don't think we're not going to write shit ones now.
No.
We've only done two, and they're kind of... They're all right. I'm like, yeah, these are pretty good, you know?
So, and by the way we are these days with recording, it's like, you can just keep recording. There's no 2-inch tape to worry about anymore. It's just hard drive space. And once you deal with that, and, you know, and the way things have gone between even 10 years from now, how things sound compared to they did 10 years ago, oh, my God. It's... Who needs tape?
Yeah.
They fixed it.
I'm sure we're not going to record 20 and keep 10. I'm sure we're going to record 10 and put them out.
Because
this would be like, you know, we never recorded a lot of dross.
Mm-hmm.
You know, our albums are generally fairly deep. And our second album isn't so great, but we didn't record a lot of shit. Like, there's a lot of other bands.
Reaction? Is that the Reaction one?
Or no, the second one was with Garth out at the Mushroom, where we spent all the money on it.
And
it's kind
of
bland sounding, kind of homogenized sounding. A few of the songs are okay, but there's a little bit of weaker material, whereas the first and the third don't really have any shit on them.
No.
But the second one, it's not our best effort, but... you know.
What's the one you did at the old Reaction, which with...
we did the first and third there.
Third one, yeah. Yeah,
both,
that
both.
Was...
Even the first one was done there with the same engineer, too. Matt DiMatteo ran the boards for both. Chris Wardman produced the first, and Matt produced the third.
Well, that third one, I remember that, because I was sort of in that mix around that time. And I always thought it was crazy. Like, you're just like, we're writing songs in the studio. Are you high?
We did the second. Yeah, we were. We did the second half of it in the studio, actually. Yeah, we did those six songs. We got in the studio. And everyone looked at me, because I was the one who, by that point, brought all the riffs. And they said that. They go, what do you got? And I went, absolutely nothing. And I said, give me a second. I went in the other room where the coffee machine and the couches were.
Yeah, yeah.
I came up with the 4-chord riff for Get Out of My Way. I brought it back in. I'm like, let's try this. And we did it, and then we were off and running. And we wrote the first six songs on that album, just in a couple-day session. And I think we got... We got one hit out of it because Soul for Sale was written in that same session.
Absolutely, yeah.
And but the six songs are all fine. They're like great.
Yeah.
You know, they, if anything, the only thing they lack is some of them lack middle eights because they were written so quickly.
There's no bridge.
That they're verse, chorus.
Yeah.
You know, so so there's one thing that you can see is a little depth in the songwriting is lacking. But verse, chorus, verse works in rock and roll too. So
yeah. When you write songs, writing bridges is always like this hit and miss thing with me.
Yeah.
It's either it really, something completely.
It presents itself.
Absolutely.
Or it doesn't.
Yeah, it writes itself, or it's just nuts. Or it's just try.
Yeah, I always flip down to the minor chord and start there and see where I can get from the whatever the key is. You know, that's my ipso facto.
I always go up. That's funny you'd say that, because you'd drop it down.
I drop it down. No, sometimes I do go up too. Sometimes I'll go up to the third, the minor up. But I always default to the minor.
Yeah.
Minor chord part of the major chord progression.
Okay,
you know?
Yeah. I don't think majors and minors, man. I just see the music, man.
No, I'm not. You know me. I'm not Mr. Musical.
K. Mozart.
But I'm the worst for that. You ask me chord names, and I called them like, oh, that's a, it's not a 7-flat 5. That's the Jimi Hendrix chord.
Oh, I don't know what those chords are either.
Yeah.
I know. I recorded this guy who taught himself guitar, and he learned how to play guitar wrong, but it was right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Like
there
the
is
chords,
no wrong.
He was playing a G chord that I've never seen anybody play G chord before, and I was completely blown away.
Is that Georgie?
Scott, thanks so much for doing this, man.
You're welcome.
And we will keep in touch.
All right.
I do this. We do a mic cheers. It's a thing I do.
Mic
ready?
Cheers?
Here we go. Cheers.
Cheers. Salute.
Scott McCullough, everybody. Everybody. Rate and review this show on iTunes. I say it every week. Find the Apologue Podcast on iTunes. Give it a ratings. Give it a review. Subscribe to the show. Help us out with that. Okay? Great. Follow me on Twitter at SimonHead666. You can also like the show on Facebook, which is facebook.com/ApologuePod. Don't forget about the Patreon campaign, patreon.com/apologue. Pledge as little or as much as you want to help the show out. Think of it like PBS. Remember when PBS used to do those crazy little pledges? They had like pledging week. Well, just imagine that, but it's every week is pledging week for me. Really, in all honesty, it does help the show. It costs money to do these things. Podcasts are free for people, but how... The dream would be is if this show could actually just pay for itself. So all the gas I put in my car, all the hosting services and all the computer software and the speakers, if somehow that could get paid for, that to me is a dream come true. Okay. Make a dream come true, man. Amazon affiliate program is another way I'm going to make my millions. It's by going to the apologue.ca and clicking on the banners on the right side. Bookmark those bannered links, and every time you shop, you'd be helping the show out. And I don't know who I got next week, but you know what I do got? I got another show. Forgot to mention, this is episode number 50. I've done 50 of these shows. I never even thought I'd be able to get past 10 because I didn't think I knew that many people. But turns out I know a lot of people. And I've been getting a lot of help over the past couple of months. Notable people would be Melanie Kay. Thank you so much, Melanie, for helping me out with the interviews that I've been getting from you and all the people that I've been meeting. Old friends, reacquainting with old friends. This has been really, really positive for me. That's all I got, okay? So, thanks again. We'll see y'all next week for episode number 51. Okay, everybody, I'll see you next week. I'll be here. Bye.